Warning, the hosts of this program are not broadcast professionals. They have no idea what they're doing. They are bad at this. One of them uses swear words. A lot. All complaints about this show are correct. You have been warned. This is your last chance to download a real podcast. Okay, you asked for it. Here are Dave Brown and Iron Mike Irons. This is Entitled Town.
All right. Thank you, Al, for an announcement. We're here. This is Entitled Town. I'm here with Iron Mike Irons. I am Dave Brown. We are all socially distant. Al did not come into the Entitled Town offices today. He is working remotely from home. I have to say his sound was exceptional. His sound quality, so well played, Al. Al has is completely drug and disease free. So that is a nice update. We've had a lot of bad news recently, but the good news is that Al is doing fine. And I think really we could probably end the show here because that's all people wanted to know is how is Al doing? And the answer is that he is doing fantastic.
You may say that Al is social distancing, Dave. I say it may have to do with a restraining order.
Well, that would be like anti-social distancing.
Well, we are talking about Al.
All right. Well,
greetings from the sunny Pacific Northwest, Dave.
It is good to be here. It is wild listening to a lot of other shows the last couple of weeks. Howard Stern doing a show on Zoom and sounding about as professional as we do.
We're trendsetters. Yeah,
I know. I was like, there's that, you know, that thing that Zoom does sometimes. And I'm now aware that listeners of our show also hear it, but does it. And then the voice goes out and you don't hear anybody say anything. I was hearing that on Howard Stern, which is, you know, probably the of all the things you could listen to is probably the most listened to show. And, you know, there's probably some like, there are probably like some religious programs that are heard by like a billion people all at once. Okay. So, but yeah, outside of that category, all the entertainment choices, probably the top one. And cause I can already hear like Twitter lighting up and telling me, they're going to tell me someone I've never heard of is the most listened to. But anyway, but hearing that on the show of that caliber, it was wild. And so, it makes me feel like what we've been doing this whole time is now the standard. So yeah, isn't that fantastic?
People are
has come down to our level.
The audio equivalent of stepping on each other's dicks time and again. It's I've been unfortunately been listening to a lot of Simmons's podcast, and they listen again. We were doing it way before it was cool enough for The Ringer and Spotify. These are weird times.
So it is weird times, and they're. Isn't much in the sports world to talk about, but we chose to do a niche show about the Patriots and how they are covered. And that is about the only thing happening in sports right now, in sports media, is covering the Patriots because of the big Tom Brady move to Tampa Bay, which we've gone over on the show. But, you know, It's still being covered. It's still being written about because there's nothing. There are no games to write about. There are no players. Okay, you had NFL free agency. You have the draft coming up, but the one story that kind of kicks around and is probably having a longer shelf life than it would have otherwise is Tom Brady taking a break from the Patriots and going to Tampa for a football season that we don't even know will happen. But it is sort of the. You know, the story that gives us some life here because it keeps producing content for other people. And therefore, we're here to evaluate what that content is. Does it make sense? And a piece today that caught your attention was on ESPN. The headline is, "The Bucks built it. Tom Brady came. Now what? Inside the GOAT's ultimate gamble." And before we get into Ian O'Connor's piece on Operation Shoeless Joe Jackson, which is actually what they called, what the Buccaneers called their plan to acquire Tom Brady. Before we get into that, I will just say this idea of like Tom Brady's big gamble, okay? Because they're talking about his legacy, right? There is no gamble of Tom Brady's legacy. This idea of legacy. And, you know, whether a player making this decision is going to somehow tarnish his career is completely absurd. There's really no, like, who did that? You know, I mean, people will talk about, like, Muhammad Ali's last few fights were tough to watch. And sure. But is Muhammad Ali remembered as not a good fighter? No. He's remembered as one of the all-time greats and perhaps the greatest fighter ever. You know, I feel like this argument started when Babe Ruth had one bad season at the end of his career, and it was hard for people to watch. And since then, they've all been demanding that everyone retire early, that nobody take any chances, that nobody live their lives, that there's this sports writer invented conversation that's, whoa, careful with your legacy. You're carrying around a very fragile legacy. You only won 6 Super Bowls, Tom. Don't go have 2 bad seasons at the end of it after 20 years because then we're going to watch your 30 for 30. And it's going to be like 2 minutes in there where everyone talks about how, well, those 2 years weren't great.
No, it doesn't matter anyway, Brown. He's a system quarterback.
Like I saw, right, of course. Right, that's the other thing. Yes, now that he's left the Patriots, he's no longer, I haven't seen anyone anywhere say that Tampa Bay is going to be terrible because Tom Brady's a system quarterback. I have not seen that take anywhere. And this thing about legacy, look, I saw Michael Jordan play for the Wizards. I saw one of the worst losses, regular season losses in Celtics history. It was opening night, I think 2002. Yeah, it was 2002 in DC. And I remember watching Michael Jordan. He was awesome. It was his last year of his career. And yeah, that team didn't go anywhere, and Jordan wasn't as good as he was, but there were spurts in that game where it was like, oh my God, this is the only time I ever saw him live in person. And I was like, he is at play for bursts of the game. He played a level above everyone else. And then he didn't really have the legs to give it, you know, the full 48 minutes. But anyway, no one sits around going, well, Michael Jordan would be the greatest player, except he was careless with his legacy. And he went and played 2 seasons with the Washington Wizards. And if he hadn't done that, he'd be the greatest player of all time. But instead, he's just some rando. Just another guy, because he broke his fragile legacy. No, he had 6 rings. Tom Brady has 6 rings. Derek Jeter, not great in his last year with the Yankees. Guess what? 5 rings.
Nobody talks about how Michael Jordan's last team went 37-45, and they won't talk about it in the future after it happens if Brady goes 6-10 in his last season. All this is, you throw a blanket over both Jordan and Brady on this point. Jordan, especially because the ESPN documentary is coming out early because people are starving for original content. And it's nothing more the tried and true formula for ESPN, Brady or Belichick equals clicks. That's all this is. And this O'Connor piece is embarrassing. It is a full frontal rubdown to someone who is probably his source, the Bucks general manager, Jason Light. It is embarrassing.
Well, let me... before we get into that, I'll just finish up this thought, which is this idea, this legacy question. Okay,
it's a straw man argument. That's all it is.
Well, it's sort of like it's a straw man conversation. Like we're going to invent this thing to talk about something because we don't have anything real to talk about, and it is so ingrained in sports media that no one thinks twice about it. It's just a reflexive. As soon as somebody's late in their career. Starts to think about where they're going to go, then the sports writers start thinking like sports writers. And they actually apply this logic. They put this logic in the heads of people like Tom Brady. They say, well, you know, Tom Brady, worry about his legacy. Tom Brady is not sitting around worrying about how people are going to think about him in 20 years. Most of that work is already done. Brady's biography is 90% written. When I say 90%, I'm leaving 10% just in case, you know, if he goes and wins a Super Bowl or if he goes and wins 2 Super Bowls. That's going to be the last 10% of his story, all right? It's all there. It's all in stone. He won. The only way you could harm a legacy is if you did something like O.J. Simpson, because the question floating around, there's been a top name your top five running backs question floating around Twitter the last few days, and I have no idea what that banging was, by the way. That's just background noise in my house. This is another thing that I've noticed on shows is like people are having background noise in their houses. Most cases it's children and who knows?
Idiots. They're just like us.
My child could be a surprise guest. I may have ruined the surprise, but he could be. It's going to be a surprise to me if he comes in, but it could happen at any time.
It'd be our first interview it's going to ruin
our legacy. That's what I'm worried about most. Is that if we have a child, come on.
It could only improve our legacy. this whole article, Dave, has Brady in the headline for clickbait because Brady equals clicks, but all it is, as I mentioned, it is a foot rub for Jason Light. It is embarrassing. This is payback for a source.
What do you most take issue with in the story? You said it. You said you found it laughable. That you were laughing while you.
I did. It's absolutely laughable. It basically tries to paint what O'Connor is doing is painting Jason Light as a pillar of strength from the Belichick tree. And the article is crafted in a way, and this has been a narrative, not just in this article, it's kind of been a narrative that's been set up, is that Brady had to sell himself to the Bucs. And because he wanted to be there so badly with media darling Bruce Arians and Light and this beautiful, this machine that he's built in Tampa, which going into last year, his record was 27-53, I believe. If you play the game with the media, you're a good, that's Jason Light. Arians is the third coach that Light has hired, and they haven't made the playoffs and they haven't been over 500 yet.
Well, I was saying, when we talked about this before the show, I was saying that there is a really interesting case that someone has made that Light has a burner account on Twitter or used to have a burner account on Twitter where he would just go and talk about how great Jameis Winston is. Like people accuse me of being too complimentary to Bill Belichick, too complimentary to Tom Brady, and then I'm like an apologist and I ignore all of their flaws. If you want to know what that really looks like, it's not when you say if I say Tom Brady's the greatest ever, that's not hyperbole, that's not unreasonable. I think he's the best ever. I've made the argument many times, but there are other people who have their own arguments that aren't necessarily crazy. What is crazy is this guy Light, the supposed burner account that they're saying is his, and I really implore you to go Google this and see the evidence for this possibly being his burner account.
Colangelo 2.0.
Oh, but like, but Colangelo used his to knock players. This account is like, and Jameis Winston lost his job periodically at times. And last year threw 30 interceptions, 30 touchdowns, 30 interceptions.
3-0, 30-30 club.
And this account will say things like, well, yeah, but only one of the five interceptions was on him. And it's like, to think that that's the way the general manager is thinking, that is fascinating.
It's basically what the Boston media did for Drew Bledsoe in the late 90s. And there's only, if you look up the Jason Light, alleged Jason Light burner account, there's probably only three entities it could be. One is a family member of Jameis Winston. Two would be the person who employed Jameis Winston. Or three, a Twitter account held by NFC South defensive backs who need those interceptions to get raises. It is Colangelo-esque in that way. And this piece that O'Connor wrote Sunday on ESPN, it basically reeks of somebody editing their own Wikipedia page with superlatives.
Yikes. Well, you remember, I mean, you know, O'Connor he's very prescient. You remember when Bill Belichick came to New England, I believe he was a huge supporter of that move, right?
Oh, of course he was. There's a line in this piece that I got to read really quickly, Dave. Though a big believer in Bill Belichick, Light was never one of the Westworld-like robots sometimes churned out by the Belichick assembly line.
Jeez.
One former Patriot colleague described Light as the most personable executive to pass through Foxborough during the Belichick-Brady years. Some might say that's damning with faint praise. Jason Light, said the former colleague, you can drop him into a cave in Afghanistan, and he's going to talk to somebody.
Oh, jeez.
Vomit emoji.
Okay. I mean,
this is a guy who traded up into the second round to draft Roberto Aguayo, the place
that was
kicker.
So great. That was so great. His explanation afterwards was fascinating. It was like, well, we were once talking about personnel, and Bill Belichick said, you know, raise your hand if you think that Steven Guskowski is one of the top 10 most important players on a roster, or something like that, right? I'm paraphrasing, but it was something along those lines. And Light was like, oh my God. Like he then explained all of the things that Guskowski does. And he's like, it just completely won me over. Like this idea that how important the kicker is to the field position game, to putting points on the board. And it's like, okay, yes, finding the right kicker is important. That doesn't mean you draft them 3 rounds before anybody else is looking for them. I think Guskowski was a 4th round pick.
He was from Memphis. Early. Yeah, he was
early.
He was kicker. He was early.
But that's what would now be called a day 3 pick.
It's an idiot overreaction, and it's the same argument I've made with media pounding the table over and over, like, oh, you gotta draft the tight end high because Rob Gronkowski was such a big factor.
Such a joke.
It's this tight end overvaluing tight ends.
By the way, I was earlier referring to what Ian O'Connor said when Belichick was hired, and it was not complimentary. It was he said, "What? Do you remember the headline, Ian O'Connor's column?"
No, they're typically not memorable, but
no, it is. It's very memorable. It's I believe with all of my heart, I believe that Ian O'Connor wrote a book about Bill Belichick.
He did.
So that when you Google Ian O'Connor Belichick, the first thing that will come up will not be one of the most famous, we've talked about in the show, one of the most famous cold takes of all time.
And oh, yes, you're right.
Patriots will regret hiring Belichick. And you know what? They do, because 20 years later, Tom Brady got away. He was right. Nailed it. Operation Shoeless Joe took Brady right out of town.
Operation Shoeless Joe. The other thing that I've kind of been putting the pieces together in my head about all this love for Jason Light over the past few weeks is that, you know, they have so many first rounders on their roster. Now, some of them might be failed first rounders. Some of them might have been in the league 10, 12 years, but they're first rounders. Somebody paid a sticker price for them, so they must be good.
Right. You know, another thing that I've observed the last couple weeks is that after Brady signed, like Adam Schefter said, that we were now going to see like a run of free agents going to Tampa to play with Tom Brady.
That's true. Blaine Gabbert re-signed there.
Yeah. Blaine Gabbert was one of, I believe, 3 players who have signed to Tampa since Brady. One was a backup, a lineman from the Colts whose name I don't remember. And I'm not going to look it up because that's what matters here, is that it's a guy's name I just don't remember. He's like a swing tackle who, you know, nice depth piece, but not a guy who was like, it's not like everybody was lining up to sign a player who played 17% of the Colts offensive snaps last year. Okay. Which is about where he was. And then they signed their biggest signing since Brady was Dominguez Sue. Who, I mean, yeah, good player, but they already had him.
Yeah, he was a re-sign, correct.
They re-signed him from last year. And with Sue, I almost wonder if bringing in Brady might have led him to think about going somewhere else, because he doesn't care much for Tom. Or he hasn't in the past. I'm sure he likes being on his team. I'm sure that's good. But it was a bargain, and it was kind of a bargain deal. But Sue isn't like... This isn't 10 years ago. He's not the guy that everybody's looking for. Not a big ticket free agent. Not a guy you would build your season ticket package around. So,
He is, I heard of him, that has mediates, you know, creaming in themselves in their pants, however.
Not even anymore. Like this year's Sue sweepstakes was not particularly, I mean, he was the guy now who is in that spot where Sue was a few years ago when he signed with the Dolphins. That guy now is Jadeveon Clowney, who people are looking at to set the market for his position on defense right now. So, anyway,
another I heard of him who can't stay on the field. He played for the Seahawks last year, and
yes,
he had marginal. He had marginal impact. He can't. He's one of those guys who can't stay healthy.
I don't necessarily believe that those guys exist. I think it's just bad luck, but you know, but that's a conversation probably for another time. So, okay. Naturally, when we talk about dumb conversations, we talked earlier about the idea of legacy and how it's not really a thing. In a similar vein, they have since Brady left, and really it's been an ongoing thing, an ongoing absurd issue, that this invented nonsense of who's more important to the Patriots dynasty, Bill or Tom. It's a little kind of a chicken and egg type thing. And I'm going to preface this segment of the show by saying that I think it's completely absurd to look at any championship team and be like, well, or look at this run of six championships and say that one of those two is more important. It's completely ridiculous. Of course, they don't win six championships without Tom Brady. And of course, they don't win six championships without Bill Belichick. In my mind, perfect example of this is Brady in overtime in Kansas City throwing those three conversions on 3rd and 10. Okay. And then that gets them the win that gets them to Super Bowl 53. And in Super Bowl 53, the Rams defense did an outstanding job, held New England to 13 points. And it didn't matter because the defense that Belichick had out there held the Rams to 3. It was a look that they had not that the Patriots had not shown anybody really the whole season, that quarters defense. And it was the innovation that really helped slow the Rams going into this most recent season. And it was something they had to deal with for a long time with teams giving them that look. And so Belichick, you know, making the right call there, and Brady making those tremendous plays in overtime, that's where you see the whole the melding of a great coach and a great quarterback. And that's what it takes to put together six wins. It also takes the contributions of the whole 53-man roster. You have to get everything right. Belichick carries a little bit more responsibility too because he's the GM. But when you're looking back, this idea, and we're going to – we'll get into some of the specifics in a second, but this idea that you can kind of separate and, you know, you send Tom Brady out to play with whoever, or you send Belichick a different quarterback, you know, how would it have shaken out? It's ridiculous. To say that one is more responsible than the other is, again, a made-up, let's fill some space content, because when you have an argument that's impossible to solve, you can get a few strong opinions pushing that argument into infinity. It's an endless resource of nonsense conversation. And so I think that has kind of reached peak crazy this week now that Brady's moved on. And supposedly, like, the idea is that we're going to get to see, ooh, who is more important? Because if the Patriots have a great season, Bill was more important. If Tom has a great season, he was more important. That doesn't make any sense. There's so many confounding variables. You can't go and say, you could say, okay, Tom Brady had a good season with the 2020 Bucks, perhaps, but does that mean that if a different person had coached the 2004 Patriots, that Brady would have led that team to the Super Bowl? No.
It's not a binary argument. It just isn't. No,
it's not. And it's unscientific. It's all of the things that media should not embrace. It's unprovable, it's absurd, and it teaches people to think in a really stupid way. So with that in mind, let's go to the illustrious Mike Greenberg. And hold on. This is going to be the sound of me hitting the mute button. Mike, I don't know the answer to this question, but I need to vamp for a second to cue this up because my cue reset. I queued it up before the show, and it has since reset. So here's what I'm going to ask you to do. Can you just tell me how you feel about Mike Greenberg while I do this? I don't even know the answer.
Greenberg, first of all, he's borrowed Lou Maloney's
hair. I think it's just 1 point as a double.
The voice annoys the hell out of me. He used to be the voice of my commute in the morning on my way to work. He is the epitome of just a know-nothing talking head. His claim to fame is that he's a Jets fan, so we should probably pray for his mortal soul as it is. But he's just a talking head. He is the dictionary definition of a replacement-level media who looks good on TV and can read a teleprompter.
All right, well, here is a recent here's a recent offering from Mike Greenberg, whose theory is that Belichick, now that Brady is gone, we're going to actually get a sense of who's more important, and he wants to tell us how terrible Belichick was without Tom Brady.
Probably the most asked question in the NFL over the last two decades, is it Brady or is it Bill?
No, it isn't. Wait, sorry. It's not the most asked question in the NFL over the last two decades, is Brady or Bill? I gave you 6 seconds of Greenberg and I'm already upset. That is not the most asked question in the NFL of the last two decades.
You have to start to build a straw man somewhere.
Right. Like, what do you think the most important issue in the NFL has been for the last two decades? You've got concussions. You've got salary cap management. You had almost a labor stoppage at the end of the last CBA. You had this time around the 17th game. You had the kneeling thing. I feel like all of these things are bigger than this question of who's more important than Brady or Bill. This has not been the biggest question in the NFL for the last two decades.
Who is most responsible for the unprecedented run of success the Patriots have enjoyed over 20 years? Maybe this year we will finally find out. Meanwhile, it seems worth reminding you that while there is no way to evaluate Brady without Bill.
There's no way. There's no way to evaluate Brady without Bill. Because Brady's never won a game in the NFL without Bill Belichick. I'm sure he will when we start playing again. But Bill drafted him in the sixth round where no one was really looking for Tom Brady and kept him as a fourth man on that roster in 2000 when they didn't need four quarterbacks. Okay. And then developed him. And then he became the starter after Drew Bledsoe got hurt. Okay. So let's just be clear that Tom Brady didn't just show up and dominate. He was to any degree that you want to give Tom Brady the credit here, how do you overlook the fact that Belichick made decisions that affected his ability to contribute? If Brady isn't chosen by the Patriots at 199, he probably goes into the seventh round. And then the 49ers who took Timber Tay, because that was the player the Patriots were looking at. They were looking at Brady and Timber Tay. The 49ers took Tay after Brady was off the board. Maybe they take Tay anyway. And then where's Brady? Maybe he's undrafted. Okay. Anyway, that's why we have nothing else to compare with Tom Brady. So now what Mike Greenberg is going to do is he's going to compare Belichick's pre-Brady performance from 30 years ago.
Because it has never happened, there is plenty of data to evaluate Bill without Brady. And for whatever it's worth.
Plenty of data. In other words, games from 30 years ago. That's all the data that there is. Context-free, here it comes.
It's not a pretty picture. Bill Belichick.
Not a pretty picture. Okay. It's not a pretty picture. Watch how he paints it. If you take ketchup, and if I wanted to do, I don't know who you think the most attractive woman in the world is, but if I painted her with ketchup on a bathroom wall at Penn Station, then it wouldn't be a pretty picture.
That depends. Is that ketchup Jim Murray approved?
Let's say I'm using an off-brand ketchup, like I'm not using Heinz. If I go and try to paint a picture of this very attractive woman, objectively everyone thinks she's pretty. If I go try to paint a picture with ketchup on the wall of a bathroom at Penn Station, okay?
That's a disturbing visual. Can we just move on to the point?
Yeah. The point being, it's not a pretty picture if you choose to paint it in an ugly way.
Belichick coached exactly 100 games before Tom Brady's first start. He was 42-58. Most of that was in Cleveland, where he took over a Browns team that had made the playoffs five out of six years.
Stop it.
He coached them.
Five out of 6 years. They made.
What Belichick did. Let's do a deeper dive on this. He inherited a 3-13 team that had been to back-to-back conference championship games in the late 80s. We both know how those games ended in heartbreaking fashion, the Broncos.
You're even overselling it. To say five of the previous 6 years, that sort of implies that, like, the 1 year they didn't go was in the middle of that six. It was the year before he showed up. They were a playoff team for five consecutive years and then went 3-13. They were abysmal.
That was a team that had gotten old and stale with the same players. We'll call them the Kozar core, for lack of a better phrase.
Does Bill Walsh ever get buried in this argument?
No, I actually have that written down, Dave. Does anybody worry about what Bill Walsh did with Steve DeBerg before Montana was a starter? Similarly, does Jimmy Johnson take shit because he never won with Aikman and he couldn't win with Marino in Miami? No, though empirically, both of those guys are all-time great coaches. And maybe they played more grab ass with the media than Belichick had. The Browns were a goddamn disaster the year before Belichick got there.
Walsh was a disaster before Joe Montana came along. And I've never, his first 2 years, and Montana went like 2-5 in, he started like seven of those games and went, I think, 2-5 in them in 79 and 80. And then the 49ers won the Super Bowl in 1981. They pulled it together. And the legends began. But people don't kill Bill Walsh because before Montana took over the job permanently, he had, like, I think he was like 4-19 or something. It was embarrassing. Let's also look at the point differential for the Browns in 1990. They were outscored. This is the year before Belichick came over. They were 27th in the league in points scored. They were 28th in points against. They were outscored by an average margin of 2 touchdowns that season. That's how bad that team was.
They were second to last on offense, last on defense.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't even thinking about that. You're right.
Unbelievable.
28. Right. They couldn't be any worse. But you're going to sell it as this is a team that had been in the playoffs five of the previous 6 years. Belichick came in, had to do a rebuild, won six games, and I think that they're so they were outscored by 234 points.
More than 2-1 margin.
In 1990. By 234 points, they were outscored.
This was not
the next year?
This was not Barry Switzer walking into Jimmy Johnson's Cowboys. Let's not make it that.
The next year, in 1991, when they went 6-10, and this is the year we're trashing them for, Belichick brought them from second to last and last in offense and defense to 16th out of 28 and 14th out of 28 in offense and defense. They were outscored by their opponents by a total of 5 points. Their Pythagorean win-loss for that year was about 500. Like, they played about as good as a 500 team. And, you know, sometimes the cookie crumbles a certain way and you win six games instead of eight. All right. The next year, the defense got up to 10th in the league. Their offense regressed. Was this the year? Okay, so they win seven games in Belichick's second season. And I think this is where the whole Bernie Kozak, the Bernie Kozar, Mike Tomczak thing, combine them together and you get Bernie Kozak for some reason.
He gets shit, eternal shit, for letting Kozar go, led by known plagiarist Ron Borges. Kozar never played an elongated stretch as an NFL starter again unless he was backing up Aikman in Detroit and winning Super Bowls, you know, on the sidelines. Cozar was done as an effective starter when Belichick benched him. And again, Ron Borges tried to sell it that he benched him for Todd Philcox, which is a flat-out lie. Bill Belichick actually resurrected the career of Vinny Testaverde, who was a abject disaster with the Buccaneers.
Quote,
Right. And, all right. So let's get back into, Greenberg's nonsense.
Most of that was in Cleveland, where he took over a Browns team that had made the playoffs 5 out of 6 years. He coached them 5 seasons. He had losing records in 4. By the way, Nick Saban was his defensive coordinator 4 of those 5 seasons. And yes, the ending was a terrible situation. The team planning to relocate to Baltimore. Factor that in however you like.
It was an unmitigated disaster. The team quit.
They made documentaries about it.
Yeah, it was just one of the worst things that could have happened to any head coach. And at no point here does he mention, okay, so Belichick was there for 5 seasons, he said, and had losing records in 4 of them. So is that even right?
It is correct. 6-10, 2-7-9 seasons, the 11-5 season where they beat Parcells Patriots in the playoff game, and then the season we're talking about now, the 95 Browns, who started 3-1, finished 5-11, and then moved to Baltimore.
Right. So they got to 7-9 in Belichick's third season, and then in his fourth season, they finally got some offense. In his fourth season, when they had the league's best defense, okay, and they had the league's 11th offense, they went 11-5. Doesn't mention that. Doesn't mention that they beat Parcells in the playoffs. All right, here we go.
Then he went to New England. Belichick was 5-13 with Drew Bledsoe, number one overall draft pick, at quarterback. Then Brady took over.
Okay. First of all, we've had Matt Chatham on this show come in and talk about how important that 5-win season in 2000 was, where they basically cleaned house. They set a year, and they took that year and they built a culture. They then went on and signed a ton of free agents with Belichick in control of personnel. They went and they signed a ton of free agents who came in and completely turned this team around. The defense, in 2000. The defense in 2000 was 17th in the league, allowed 21.1 points per game. The next year, they were 6th in points against. It was a huge turnaround, and it was a big reason why their offense also improved that year, because when he talks about it, he says, and then Tom Brady took over. As if that's what changed. And it was one thing that changed, but there was a lot of change from 2000 to 2001. A key change was that they forced more turnovers, they allowed fewer points, they had better field position. Because I'll tell you this, the DVOA for the 2000 Patriots offense was higher than the DVOA for the 2001 Patriots offense. Drew Bledsoe had a more efficient offense in 2000 than Tom Brady did in 2001. Now, there are a lot of qualities that made Tom Brady the right quarterback for that team. Bledsoe, a little more prone to mistakes late in the game. Brady, a little more of what they called a game manager at the time. But he was an above average quarterback in that first season.
I'd argue that shines a light on why DVOA can be full of shit sometimes.
Well, no.
I hate to be the eye test asshole, but...
No. It makes a lot of sense because here's what happened. They needed a guy. They didn't need a guy to do what Drew Bledsoe was doing. They needed a guy to manage the offense, prevent turnovers, have the ability to make those plays like he did at the end of Super Bowl 36, okay? To stay, like with Drew Bledsoe, like just ignore Charlie Weiss and go out there and sling it. They needed a guy who wasn't going to do that.
Look at the first play on the final drive of Super Bowl 36.
Yes.
Leonard Little almost strip sacks Brady. Brady has two hands on the football, steps up and dumps it off for a gain.
Right. That's what they needed. Yes. Now, this is not Hall of Fame level quarterbacking in season one. Okay. It's just not. He's not there yet. And that's fine. His adjusted net yards per attempt that year, 5.39. That's not great. Okay. That's nothing special at all. His career, okay. His Tom Brady's career average net yards per attempt is 7.08. And by the way, that's incredible. Okay. But 5.39 is not very good. It's fine. In fact, you probably want something better, and he will get better. He becomes in 2007, he leads the league with 8.88. In 2010, 8.25 adjusted net yards per attempt. And just trust me, that's a very good indicator of efficiency. They were not a particularly efficient offense. They had a lot of good field position. They benefited from a lot of turnovers. They also turned over the ball more in 2001 than they did in 2000. People didn't know that. It's true. His sack rate in 2001 is horrible. What was his sack rate? I believe it was 9%. His career, Tom Brady's career sack rate is 4.8%. In 2001, he was at 9. Okay? That's entirely unacceptable. But they worked with him. They did what this coaching staff does. They played to his strengths. Okay? Charlie Weiss put together an offense that fit Tom Brady, and it all started to work. It was the product of that. I mean, that team, that 2001 team, more than anything else, is the product of it's the whole do your job philosophy. It's the whole Patriot way. It's the whole thing. It's all of it coming together. It's not just Bill going out and signing the right free agents. It's not just the change from Brady to Bledsoe, from Bledsoe to Brady. Okay. It's a lot of things. One of the most impressive accomplishments of Bill Belichick's career is taking a 6th-round draft pick who was in his second season, who barely made the roster the year before, and was still 4th on the depth chart when that season started, okay? Fashioning him into a player who was ready to take over the next year and getting as much out of him as he did and getting that team to the Super Bowl. It's one of the best accomplishments in the history of coaching, okay? In the NFL. Now, Tom Brady. Let's go back to, let's let Greenberg finish unless you have a point here.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
In his first start, he beat Peyton Manning and the Colts by 31 points as a...
Oh, my God. They beat Peyton Manning and the Colts by 31 points. They had more rushing yards in that game than passing yards. Okay.
Brady did not throw a touchdown in that game.
Brady did not throw a touchdown, and the defense produced 4 turnovers.
It's a double-digit underdog.
Manning threw 2 touchdowns. He then went 13 and.
This would be like, could you imagine if people looked at like the Jacoby Brissett won by 27 points in his NFL debut, right?
Good point.
You know what I mean? Like, could we talk about how great he beat? They had Osweiler at the time, so no one's really going to get psyched up about that, but man.
3 the rest of the way and won the Super Bowl. Brady went on to average 28 points a game as a starter over his Patriots career. That is the most by any quarterback ever. In games started by anyone else, Belichick's teams have averaged 19 points. Brady also won 6 playoff games in which his team allowed 28 or more points. No other quarterback has ever won more than 2. And Brady made himself a salary cap bargain. In none of his championship seasons was Brady a top 10 cap hit in the league. So, what does all of this mean? Certainly doesn't necessarily take anything away from Belichick as a coach. I believe he is the greatest in the history of American team sports. But the facts are the facts. So, if he is ever going to accomplish anything without Tom Brady, he's going to have to start doing it now.
Really? If he's going to start accomplishing things without Tom Brady, he's going to have to start doing it now, you think?
He hasn't done anything
yet,
caller.
Tom Brady's gone?
He hasn't done anything yet, caller, at all.
Well, it's completely ridiculous.
It's bullshit. It's complete utter. He doesn't even believe the bullshit he's spewing.
It is such an unfair and ridiculous way to frame this argument. It's everything that's wrong with media right now. It is, let's reduce things down to talking points that people can get on board with so that everybody can kind of be at-home pundits. But it's the wrong way to evaluate the question that you're trying to answer. It also happens to be that the question itself is stupid, but you're not going to get to that conclusion by grabbing onto these little sound bites. And like, if you're really trying to get to an answer, why are you obfuscating? Obfuscating is probably not the right word. Why are you obscuring Belichick's good season in Cleveland? Why are you painting the Browns as this like perennial playoff power when they were 3-13 and dead last in the league and scoring and second to last in defense or vice versa? And why are you doing it? Why are you talking about Tom Brady's great performance against Peyton Manning in a game where they ran for more yards than they threw for?
By the way, in that game, Brady was 13 of 23 for 163 yards, no touchdowns, no picks. Okay. Manning threw three interceptions.
Yeah, and that's what they needed. They needed Tom Brady to be that at Correct. That time. And good for him that he would, good for Tom Brady that he did it. But let's not pretend that 2001 Tom Brady and 2007 Tom Brady are the same thing. They just aren't. And the Tom Brady who won Super Bowl 49 was not available to Bill Belichick in 2001. That's not the player he had. He had a guy who was closer to like 2011 Eli Manning.
Brady had a less than 100 yards passing going into the last drive of Super Bowl 36.
Yeah, and that's fine.
Yeah, he didn't turn the ball over, and the Patriots made plays on defense and in the kicking game. That's how they won the Super Bowl in 2001.
In 2011, Eli Manning had a passer rating plus, adjusted passer rating of 111. Okay. That stat is basically saying 100 is the league average.
So compared it's to OPS plus for quarterbacks.
What's that?
It's OPS plus for quarterbacks.
It's like OPS plus for quarterbacks. So to reach out for people who don't understand stats on that level, it's comparing everybody to the league average. And Eli Manning in 2011 was at 111. So he was above average, a decent amount above average. Tom Brady in 2001 was passer plus 111. I completely nailed it, and I didn't even know that when I said that. Okay. His passer, it's the same caliber guy. Tom Brady was just as good compared to the rest of the league in 2001 as Eli Manning was in 2011. Okay? That's who he won the Super Bowl with. 2011, Eli Manning.
You making this argument is like me watching Van Gogh paint with Hunt's ketchup in real time. It's watching you make this sausage here. It's been fantastic on the shared screen we have.
By the way,
we also Scartzy just got a square in bingo with you mentioning Eli Manning and the Giants.
Fantastic. Brady's sack percentage in 2001 adjusted his sack percentage plus was 86, well below league average. He would never finish any lower than 103 for the rest of his career. And most years he was over 110.
Yeah, don't worry. It's just the system. Except when you're arguing that Brady's more important than Belichick, that is.
And Brady, and by the way, I think that sack percentage is a really good look at where Brady turned the corner, because he has just among the best pocket awareness of all time, and his ability to move in the pocket and delay the pass rush without even in a way that helps his blockers and, you know, stepping up, making small, subtle moves, like his ability he improved from 01 to 02 tremendously. Okay.
Yes, he did.
In 2002, that, which was,
led the league in touchdown passes. And that's a counting stat, but he did lead the league in touchdown passes. In 2002.
He was up 111, well over the league average in sack rate percentage. And that really came to, that's really what helped turn him into the Hall of Fame caliber Tom Brady that we now know. But back in 2001, not so much. Okay, now let's check in with another. Here's another expert who wants to weigh in on this, on Bill Belichick.
Anybody?
Can I say this? That I don't like to compare pro coaches to college coaches because it's apples and oranges comparison to me. So if we're going to go historically, I don't want to bring John Wooden into the conversation, Gino Auriemma, Nick Saban. Let's stay within the realm of professional sports. The legendary phrase, and I believe it was Bear Bryant who said it in football, is he could take your players and beat his players. Yeah. He could take his players and beat your players. Look at the number of pro bowlers on the Chargers. They beat them in the playoffs and handily. Look at the number of pro bowlers on the Chiefs. They went in there and shut them out in the first half. Look at the number of pro bowlers on the Rams. They went and shut them out in the Super Bowl in the first half last night. The two highest scoring teams in the NFL in the highest scoring season there ever was. Bill Belichick, in my opinion, is without question the best coach in the history of American team sports. And I include Phil. Yeah. Despite the fact that Phil has more championships, and I covered many of them, and I have the ultimate respect for Phil, but Phil had the better team every single time. Phil had Michael, Phil had Shaq and Kobe. He had the better team every time he won. You cannot say that about Belichick.
Oh, Mike Greenberg. That was Mike Greenberg from 2019. That was Mike Greenberg the day after Super Bowl 53.
You know what, Dave? It's almost as if he doesn't believe what he's saying. And by the way, it was Bum Phillips who said he can take yours and beat his in. He said that about Don Shula.
I think Abraham Lincoln said it.
Yeah, about Mary Todd. Yeah, I think so.
What?
Go on.
Anyway, my point here is it's just comical. It's just comical how we're going to create these straw men and then argue about it in a way that contradicts everything that he has said before.
Greenberg's a useful idiot, Dave. All he's doing is he's putting the subject on a tee. He's the host of the early morning show on ESPN. He's setting talking points, narratives for the day. He doesn't have to believe what he's saying. He just has to put the ball on the tee.
Well, and what even within this argument, right? Even within the point that he's making right now, he does ridiculous things. Like when he says his team went into Kansas City and they shut out. Now, I agree that Bill Belichick coached well in that postseason. I've said it earlier in this show. But to make the point, he went into Kansas City and he shut them out in the first half. It's like, okay, they gave up 35 points in that game. You know, like we don't have to, you don't only look at the one part that helps your argument. Look at the whole game. They did a good job. They slowed Mahomes enough. That game though was not like in the if you had a Louvre of Bill Belichick defensive coaching masterpieces, that game would not be in it. You don't have to oversell your case that Bill Belichick is a great coach. By the way, is he the greatest in the history of North American professional sports? Maybe, like, okay, I haven't even, so you're going to get into Red Auerbach, you're going to get into Phil Jackson, but then basketball is like really so invested in like having just the top player. You can win in the NFL without having the best player in the league. You can't really do that in basketball. So I don't know, but do you have to oversell it even to that degree? Because I think Belichick is the greatest coach. I think he's the greatest football coach of all time. I don't know that I need to parse out whether he's better than Red Auerbach or Phil Jackson, but and I'm sure somebody on Twitter will tell me about some coach from the NHL who
from the Scotty Bowman
probably who
Scotty Bowman.
I'm going to trust you that's a real person. So
coached the Canadiens to a number of cups and did with the Red Wings as well.
There you go. So anyway, you know. This is how crazy it gets. And here's the problem, is that people, not only do they believe these things, but then they take these ridiculous, these lazy sort of arguing methodologies, and they build their worldview around completely ridiculous data. Like the idea that Malcolm Butler played 90-some percent, like 98% or whatever it was, of the Patriots' defensive snaps in 2017. And therefore, because he played that many snaps, he was a better player that week. Okay. Never mind what happened to practice, which none of us saw. But hey, he played 90 some percent of snaps. So he must be better. Okay. Well, what about 3 years earlier when it was 2014 and he was in Super Bowl 49? He had played 17% of the Patriots' defensive snaps in 2014. So should you use that same criteria and not put Malcolm Butler into that game?
All that is moving the goalpost. It's I rail against a lot. It's the last thing I saw itis. That's all it is.
And people build this, people build their worldviews around completely irrelevant data. And these arguments are just making us into, like, I'm watching people talk about this terrible pandemic that we're dealing with. And I watch people talk about it, and it's like, you grab like one piece of one number, and then you say, and therefore, you know, it's a cold. It's the flu. And it's like,
flu.
Look around. Look, it's different. Every ICU bed in New York has it. Okay. There's something different about it. It's just self-evident even, but use better data, pay more attention, soak in everything. And we have this culture that's led us to this point of no. I found one point that I can build a fortress around, and then therefore I'm just gonna apply all of my belief system to it. Just take in more data. Be prepared for the fact that we live in ever-changing circumstances, especially in football. Football changes from down to down. Malcolm Butler may not have been the right cornerback to start Super Bowl 49, but he was the right cornerback to finish it. And that's how football works. It changes from play to play, and that's why you can't have a who's more important argument, because you know what? It really depends on down and distance, personnel on the field, decisions made in March and February, and who put the work in the offseason. Who did the guy miss the plane to Minneapolis this week? All of these little things.
2.5 years ago, Todd Gurley was being hailed as the best running back in football. He was unemployed 6 weeks ago.
Yes.
Shit changes. It is not static.
Another place where this argument shows up is people take sort of like this broad swath of data with running backs. And they say, well, running backs aren't valuable because, you know, of expected points added on a given play. And it's an efficiency argument. And they are correct that running the ball is a less efficient way to score. What they ignore is that efficiency isn't necessarily the best way to win a football game. Okay? Now, most days it is. But Super Bowl 51, the Patriots were the least efficient team in that game. They had a lower DVOA than Atlanta did. They just ran more plays. They ran more offensive plays. So at the end of the day, they got more points on the board. In Super Bowl 52, the Patriots were the more efficient team. But the Eagles ran more plays. And you know why? Because they were able to control the clock and run. They couldn't stop the Patriots for anything that day, but they were able to gain 6 yards per carry. Okay? And that's when running is important. So, you know, sometimes it does matter. Sometimes it doesn't. But when you start getting into these hard and fast rules of, okay, no, running backs don't matter. You could just find any scrub off the street. Okay.
The argument 10 years ago, 15 years ago, was if you run the ball 35 times a game, you win.
Yes. And that was stupid too.
It's another asinine argument.
And so, and the Patriots, the Earhart Perkins offense is built around the premise, throw to score, run to win. And if you think about it that way, it makes a lot of sense. Yes. Throwing is going to get you into the end zone faster. Running is how you're going to control the clock, control the tempo, and put yourself in more manageable, makeable conversion situations. So sometimes, and this is going to stun people, you're better off being less efficient on a given down. It's true. Okay. So I've exhausted myself on Mike Greenberg. Before we go, we should address one other issue, which was Julian Edelman is heading to Detroit.
Well, Bill Simmons and Ben Volen think he is.
Yeah. Well, okay. So April Fool's Day happened. And on April Fool's Day, we were already, I mean, of course, everyone's got a COVID-19 cure. Everyone's got, you know, some ridiculous football move that is coming. And
by the way, Volen was a minus 20,000 favorite to be the leader in the clubhouse of getting duped for an April Fool's gag.
Well, okay, so here's the gag. It was, I saw one about Stephon Gilmore being traded that I remember that one and being like, you're awful. Like, this is, and then I saw the Edelman one and it was just like, okay, how silly are you going to be where you have Julian Edelman be traded today? Like, everyone knows it's April 1st, except that right before he went on a podcast, Bill Simmons saw the April Fool's prank of Julian Edelman going to the Lions. And then he went on the podcast and said, what did he say? I guess Edelman's going to now. Like, is that official? Something like that, right?
Yeah, completely offhand.
I'm seeing now that you sent me a text message about...
I think it was Gio Carmazzi, who was the Niner quarterback, who was a pick ahead of Tim Rattay. Although Rattay was a Niner at one point. I could be wrong.
They drafted both that year. The 49ers draft... No, they did. I looked this up the other day because I had the same exact thought you did. Carmazzi went in the third round and he was like supposed to be their guy and he melted down like in their first like preseason game they put him in.
Yeah, ironically, I believe they played the Patriots in the Hall of Fame game that day.
Yes, yes, that's right. And that's when the GM was like, oh, I completely whiffed on Brady. And they had Rattay, and I think Rattay made the team and wound up as one of the backups to Jeff Garcia.
Correct.
So, okay. So if anybody was thinking about Carmazzi, that's what happened. Now, so anyway, Bill Simmons is sitting on the radio, and he's like, on some podcast somewhere, and he's like, oh, yeah, Julian Edelman's gone too. Because he read a tweet, didn't think about the fact that it was April Fool's Day, didn't consider how, like, didn't take the effort to ask himself, is this true? Instead, talked his mind into it being true, okay? Fitting the narrative of, okay, well, it's all coming apart for the Patriots. They're just dismantling, right? Like, just created a narrative for himself to believe so that he could go say something that ridiculous on somebody else's show. And then, how do you top that? Mike, how can you be dumber than that?
Well, let's go to Boston. Let's go to the Boston Globe and their ace NFL writer, mittens wearing dullard, Ben Volen.
Did he get this in print, by the way?
God, I would put nothing.
Volen ran with it. Volen heard Bill Simmons say it, and then he said it too. And I think he got it in print, which is, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. I'm not going to even figure this out right now. I think he got it. Now I feel like I have to find out, But this is where just because Bill Simmons said it, first of all, is Bill Simmons that plugged in? Is he breaking stories all the time? No. Why would he be the clearinghouse for that information? Okay. So ask yourself, if the only place that I've heard it is Bill Simmons saw a tweet, why am I publishing that?
It's crossing the streams. I probably overuse that saying, but it really is crossing the streams of idiocy and just inch deep analysis. I mean, Edelman just signed a contract extension. Poor Miguel Benzon, of Pat's Cap fame on Twitter, his goddamn head must have been exploding having to deal with questions from Twitter followers who have been misinformed by California Bill and the mittens wearing dullard.
Oh, and then the other great thing with Ben was the Tua thing.
Oh, yeah. Listen, the same thing as Greenberg doesn't believe what he's saying. When you have no core beliefs and you have, you know, no, just nothing inside of any gray matter that matters, you don't have to worry about it. Just the next thing that comes to mind is the most important thing. Forget about what you've written or said before. That was the great Sporty R. McKenzie tweeted out Volans.
Right.
Differing views on Tua Tagovailoa this week.
Three tweets where he just eviscerated Tua. As like,
compared him to Tim Tebow. Call them Tim Tebow 2.0. And then he has the Patriots trading their Tooney, the 23rd pick, and the 87th pick overall for the right to draft Tua.
So, right, and so now he's just giving away the farm to get Tua, which is like, okay. And this is a point that I left out when I about the Greenberg thing, is that we actually, the other thing Greenberg ignored was that we have plenty of data of Belichick without Brady. He's won 13 of his last 19 games where a different quarterback started. 15 of those games by Matt Cassel, who was a 7th round draft pick who had not started the game since high school. And people say, well, yeah, but it was a perfect team the year before. Sure. A perfect team that Bill Belichick put together. He put all of those players, he put a team around so good that they won 11 games with a 7th round draft pick who hadn't done anything. He then won 3 games in 2016. And really, if Jacoby Brissett hadn't also gotten hurt with Vince Wilfork falling on his hand, his throwing hand, causing ligament damage that needed surgery to fix, they might have gone 4-0. So we do have data. We have seen Bill Belichick win games without Tom Brady. But my point as it relates to Ben Volen is, look at those guys. Brissett was a 3rd round draft pick. Garoppolo, 2nd round draft pick. Brady, 6th round draft pick. Cassel, 7th.
By the way, the extended numbers, the deep dive in the numbers, Matt Cassel 2008 was marginally better than Tom Brady 2001.
There you go. And we've seen that Bill, and he had the same record with both of those guys, which is interesting. Hashtag interesting, Ben Volen. And it was on Colin Cowherd where Simmons went and regurgitated this false rumor. So
there's a confluence of suck, Cowherd and Simmons. Jesus Christ.
So anyway, we're just, the point is, how long have you been covering this team where you're thinking that they're just going to throw away a bunch of assets to trade up for a quarterback when they've made their bones by finding bargains at every position?
And this is after they've been flinging shit that they should tank for Trevor. What that anyone's seen in the last 20 years would lead you to believe the Patriots are going to do anything to tank?
Right.
And Volen thinks they're in for a rebuild, so he wants to trade their top 2 picks in the draft and a guard who's one of the better guards in football.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the best. And then the other things that go
around. He's also floated the idea of trading Gilmore as well, so.
Of course. Well, and listen, that's not the worst idea, okay? It's not. Now, I don't think they're going to trade Gilmore, but, you know. See, this is how everybody talks themselves. Like, okay, I have seen similar things to this. Like, they'll say, I've seen Chandler Jones get traded. And then they'll say, well, he was a good player who got traded so they could get assets out of it. Completely different situation because he wasn't under contract as long. But okay, that's how they talk themselves into it. And then instead of being like, see, what I do is I look at it and I say, that doesn't make most, these things remain possible. They remain a possibility. They then take it a step further. They go, well, because it is possible or because it is plausible, it is therefore, I must discuss it as if it is a realistic option that's probably going to happen. And that's where things get ridiculous. Just take a breath. You don't have to predict every move the team is going to make. That is not the job. Analyze the moves that happen. Maybe at a time when there's nothing else to write about, like right now.
Yeah, then that's where I'll part company with you a little bit there, Dave. I do think I do think the content's important, as long as it's not moronic content. And you can have barroom arguments on text threads with your friends and on Twitter and that sort of thing. But the stuff that Volin is spewing, and what you just highlighted with Greenberg, it's just not worth your goddamn time.
I mean, maybe at a time when there's not much else to talk about, when you have, I might be willing to give a little more license and be more entertaining of these things if it weren't what they did all the time. And the problem is that it is the moronic side of it. It is the delving into the text message group. Okay. That's not what the reporters are supposed to do. They're supposed to be above that. They're not supposed to feed that nonsense. They're not supposed to be the nonsense. And it's all just nonsense now.
But we're guilty of it as well, Dave. And we just spent the better part of an hour railing against Mike Greenberg. Mike Greenberg works for ESPN. That is, that network's slogan should be, we're hooked on moronics. That's all they do now. Between, they're running SportsCenter, you know, after 7 o'clock at night, every night with nothing. And during the day, they're speculating over nothing. They're trying to conjure stuff out of thin air. And the point was, I'm stealing the point on Twitter. I believe this was a buddy of ours, Bri, made this point. ESPN has been doing nothing. All of a sudden, Brady is the greatest quarterback in the history of football, for my money. This is a network who slandered and shit on him constantly in the wake of Deflategate for 2 years.
Right.
And it's just maddening. And I should consider the source, but it does bother me. I will say I'm proud of myself. It is triggering me less now because there are more important things going on in the world. And maybe I'm getting, as Larry Johnson on WEEI and Saturdays would say, I'm getting proper perspective. But I'm doing a better job of filtering out the idiocy and making fun of the truly moronic stuff, which is why I follow Volin on my burner.
It becomes takes on takes on takes.
Takes begot takes. You know, there is a takes pandemic in the United States. I will say that. It was specifically Boston.
Where one person reports it and then it gets aggregated. And so Volin hears Simmons say it. And then you launch 1,000 articles taking Volin's work and regurgitating that. And so now it's like almost like it was like the Tom Brady of San Francisco thing. Remember that?
Yeah, I believe that was Tom Curran started that stuff, and there was never anything to it at all. There was
nothing.
One guy who had the ear of a media member who was looking for something, looking for anything to drive clicks. There was nothing to it at all.
Well, yeah, that's what we're dealing with. So, all right. I hope we have an easier time of sorting out our next episode, because both of our schedules have been thrown into a weird, unpredictable place, but
as everybody's
to get together today. I think, do we have any emails?
We do have an email. It's from Brian in Falmouth. He loves the show and he wants to know, with everything that's going on in the world, will natural selection occur in Boston sports media? I would argue it's an unfortunate choice of words, but I would argue that Volin's being exposed, many others as well.
To the virus? What do you mean? Listen.
Well, natural selection. I'm assuming that he means natural selection will occur, filtering out the worst of the media. There's been a lot. The Herald has let go of a bunch of writers recently, a bunch of hot takers, so on and so forth. There's WEEI. WEEI is running CBS Sports Radio, or at least part of the time on the weekends. It's happened out here in the Northwest, where they're playing national programs rather than local programming on local sports radio.
Here's what's going to happen. It's going to elevate the most.
The loudest.
The lowest common denominator of the business. Mm. So I'm... When I heard natural selection, I thought it was kind of a morbid question. But if you're looking at it from a professional standpoint, they're going to cut people. Like the Herald cut their hockey writer, right? Because there's no hockey right now, and it's lesser read than something more more takey, less informative. And, you know, right now, if trash gets clicks, they're going to side with trash. So, no, it's going to be reverse natural selection in a situation like this.
Yeah, unfortunately, I tend to agree with you. I've used the tagline for a long time that I'm reading and watching this garbage. You don't have to. And I'm trying for my own sanity. I'm trying to get away from it. There's just a lot of really, really bad, ill-informed, malevolent noise out there. And frankly, I'm done with it. I like calling out the worst of the worst. Yes, Ben Volen, that usually describes you. But there's so much fluff and so much garbage. I disregard it. I disregard probably 85% of what's going on.
I feel like your sanity,
tenuous at best. I admit that.
But holding on to your sanity is probably contradictory to what this show is trying to achieve. So I don't know. This is like Vince Wilfork trying to lose 50 pounds. I'm not sure how I feel about it.
All right. That's the only email we have. That's the only email we have this week. Our Twitter account is @EntitledTown. The email address for those of you, and we would certainly welcome some feedback and love to discuss some stuff you have, is entitledtown@gmail.com.
All right, here's the reviews. Yes, we are now up to 109 ratings. We still have a 5.0 overall rating, so that's good. Here are the two written ratings that we got, and let's see. I want to read the headlines. I don't know how you do it where you can like read the headline, but anyway, it starts off with "very tough week." And then it says -except. It looked like it was going to accept, but I believe this is from our friend Ned Snark on March 19th. He said, "Joni said it best. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone?" And I feel like that. I'm not sure if that's about Tom Brady or about us taking a couple weeks off, but I want to choose to believe that he missed us more than Tom Brady. Let's see.
And Ned's quoting Peter Cetera there, I believe. It's a Chicago song from the 80s.
Why wouldn't you? Yeah. Okay, let's see. This one says, it's from someone named Castle Long One. "Great for self-quarantine" is the headline, gives us 5 stars. "Iron Mike would be great coming out of speakers in the background for those that discover your body." What?
Working blue? I mean, what the hell?
Can you make heads or tails of that?
I'm not sure I want to.
Iron Mike would be great coming out of speakers in the background for those that discover your body.
Sounds like something that Joe Haggerty would write. Jesus.
Oh, because it's great for self-quarantine. But it gave us 5 stars. So it's weird. I guess the premise is that like they're going to listen to this when you're alone in self-quarantine. You got Iron Mike coming out of the speakers, and it would be because someone comes over and finds you, and then they get to hear Iron Mike Irons.
To paraphrase Bill Simmons back in the day, yup, these are our listeners.
Well, hey, everybody's thinking. That's what I like to see. So
I would also like to point out, and this is a bit of a, I have a hair across my ass about Hammer and Ryan Hannibal and Andy Hart, their podcast, which is a radio.com/intercom production. They have 837 followers, and our little startup, the little engine that could, the bi-coastal engine that could, has 802 followers. So give us give us a follow, give us a review, send us an email. Thank you in advance.
Yes. And let's see they're a 4-star rating. They got to 100 ratings this week.
Oh, good for them.
Congratulations.
They look good in the rearview mirror.
All right. Well, I hope everyone's staying safe. I hope, you know, you're dealing with this as best as you can. And, you know, let's just keep waiting it out.
Yeah, stay safe, stay healthy, everyone. And, I don't know what we're on to, Dave, I'm glad we got to hook up today.
Do you have any TV shows to recommend to people? We talked a little bit about that last time. Do you have any thoughts? Because here's what's going to happen. Before we get this country like fully back online and everything going again, there's probably going to be a gap in new television, right?
Yeah, there's going to be a huge gap, enormous.
Like
gap.
Ozark just came out, but they're not going to be able to start making Ozark for a while, you know? And then there's other shows that we're probably working on in March that we're going to come out later this year. Those aren't going to come out of time now. And so what are we supposed to watch?
I'll tell you, I am, and this is not a complaint. The work that I do for a living, we're very, very busy, and I'm blessed and I'm grateful for that. And I realize a lot of people are not in the are not in the same position that I am. I have not watched a lot of TV. I've made a point. I'm not a big movie guy, but I've been watching a lot more movies now. I watch Dallas Buyers Club, that sort of thing.
America just needs you to name a television show.
I'm not going to mention Cheers or Seinfeld again. I can't do it. I'm not going to pull a Boston Media, Dave. I'm not going to recommend something that I haven't done a little bit of research on.
All right. I like your attitude. Let's see. Okay. What's out there? You know, I mentioned the classics last week, right? So, but I'm watching right now, watching The Leftovers, which is it's a great show on HBO. It actually might be a bad time to watch it, though, because it's based on just a horrible thing happening and how everyone deals with it. I find some useful, I find it's useful to think about those things at a time like this, but other people might not want it. They might want to escape.
Yeah, I'm doing more reading. I've listened to a lot of podcasts. I've listened to more California Bill than anybody should have to subject themselves to in a week span. But that's just a product of being in a vehicle and being in an office.
We watched Friday Night Lights, and if season 5, there's a growing disconnect between Coach Taylor and Vince Howard. So think that through. But that was a decent watch. Although the second season is like,
who's more important to the team, Dave?
You know, off the rails. Vince Howard or Coach Taylor benched Vince Howard and they won.
My column.
But yeah, I'm trying to think of like a good what was a good show was a few years ago was a show called Life. And Life was about Damian Lewis from Homeland, before he was on Homeland, and his character had been in jail and was falsely convicted, and then he won like this big settlement. So he's a detective who has just got out of jail, and they've given him like $20 million or something in a settlement from the state. So he's filthy rich. And all he's trying to do is solve the crime that he was falsely convicted of. And it's a really cool show. I like that. So Life, if you can find that somewhere, wherever that is, that's an under the radar show that you should check out. There you go.
Well, we're ending our programs now, evidently, by playing Siskel and Ebert. So I will have something for you next time.
They talked about movies. But I'll tell you what, people out there, if you can email us with shows that you would recommend, maybe we could watch them and then throw out some. Because I think this is going to go on for a while. And, this is a good opportunity to – some guy just recommended the show to me called Devs. Never heard of it. DEVS. It's on Hulu. So maybe I'll check that out, because what else am I going to do?
There you go.
All right, everybody. I think we've done a podcast here. So let's go ahead and sign off. And, be well. Stay safe. What are we on to? I think we're on to draft.
Yeah, we're on to talking about the draft and the Boston Mediates. There's going to be some shit takes coming in the week ahead.
Let's come back and revisit this, because there's all this talk about how what position should the Patriots draft? And spoiler alert for the next episode, the answer is really any position. Whatever the best player they can get is in the first round is where their head should be. They don't need a new cornerback right now. That's about it. But, would you be disappointed with a new defensive lineman or a new, guard or a new anything but running back or cornerback?
I got a good buddy of mine. I don't think you can ever go wrong building the interior of your team up strong, and they've certainly done right. That a lot in the past, the last couple of years notwithstanding. I'll leave it to the experts like Volin and his ilk to tell me what they should do, so I can completely disregard and do a 180 from what they're doing or what they're seeking.
All right, man. All right. Well, thanks for checking in with us and everybody listening out there. Stay safe, and we look forward to seeing you soon.
Take care.
Bye for now.
Awesome. Thank you, Dave.
We are still recording.
Oh, okay.
Where's the button? I found it. Okay. Bye for now.